Our fifth case for argument this morning is Newbold against the Wisconsin State Public Defender. Mr. Gracie.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Taras Gracie, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Mary Newbold. The issue presented in this case is whether equitable tolling is appropriate where, one, a claimant receives a letter from the chief legal counsel of a state agency informing her she has 300 days to file a complaint of retaliation. Two, the state's complaint form only mentions 300 days to file such complaint. And three, where that same plaintiff is proceeding pro se. I would submit that the answer to this question is yes. When Ms. Newbold was fired, she began looking into prosecuting her complaint. She wrote to various state agencies, had communications with various state agencies. The chief legal counsel of the Department of Employment Relations for the state of Wisconsin wrote to Ms. Newbold and told her that she had 300 days to proceed with her complaint. Nowhere does that letter mention a shorter 180-day period. Nowhere does it mention the need to contact anyone else. Ms. Newbold then picked up the complaint form, the state complaint form, for age, sex, and retaliation claims. That complaint form also only mentions 300 days. Nowhere in that complaint form does it mention the shorter 180-day period. Proceeding as such, Ms. Newbold, without the assistance of counsel, filled out the complaint form and submitted it within 300 days. The complaint form also has a box, and that box says, if you would like us to forward this complaint form onto the EEOC, check the box and we will do so. Nowhere does it say, again, that there's only 180 days. Ms. Newbold checked that box. When Ms. Newbold filed her complaint in May of 1996, she was within the 300-day time frame. However, the Wisconsin Personnel Commission did not forward that complaint until nearly 3 months later to the EEOC. When you contrast that with Ms. Newbold's second retaliation complaint, that is, for her name being removed from the register for public defender investigators, that complaint was...
But before we go to the delay,
sure.
I'm not... sure why, in your view, a state agency has to spell out all the details. And are you saying that there was anything in the form that was incorrect? The foreign key is referring to rights under state law. She had 300 days under state law. Is it your position that even if all the information is correct, that time is going to be extended because additional information is not provided?
I think, Judge Easterbrick, what we're really saying here is that the form is misleading. It misleads a plaintiff, such as Ms. Newbold, into believing that...
Without the footnote, maybe one could say that the form was misleading, implying that there was no difference between state and federal. But there's this footnote which says, you know, federal rights may differ. If you're interested in federal law, go contact the EEOC.
I believe you're referring to the complaint form, and that's true. It does have the footnote that says it. But there's also the letter from the chief legal counsel, and nowhere does that mention the EEOC or contacting anybody in any federal agency to discuss that matter. I believe this case is very similar to the Anderson v. Unisys case in the sister court of this court, the Eighth Circuit, whereby there the Minnesota form said you had 1 year to file. Nowhere does it mention a shorter 300-day period for an EEOC claim. And there, again, the plaintiff, proceeding pro se, the court ruled that they would equitably toll the statute due to the misleading form. I believe that's precisely the case we have here. But we have more than just that misleading form. We have a misleading letter from the chief legal counsel. Here we have a plaintiff who is unschooled in the ways of the law. She's not an attorney, and she's told, one, by a form that she has 300 days, and two, by a letter from the chief legal counsel telling her she has 300 days. So I believe when you combine those two facts, yes, it's a clear and convincing case for equitable tolling to be applied in this case.
Did she, by the way, ever do the thing that she did? Did she ever pursue the rights that she had invoked timely? That is, did she ever sue under state law?
Yes, she did, Judge Eastbrook. She filed her complaint with the Wisconsin Personnel Commission, as she was required to do so.
Mm-hmm.
They made an initial determination saying there was probable cause to proceed. She proceeded. Later, that same commission ruled that there was not a basis for her claim, and they denied that claim. She then followed up with that, requesting that the EEOC perform a substantial weight review of that claim. The EEOC then agreeing with the Wisconsin Personnel Commission. But what's interesting to note about that decision by the EEOC is
she never took legal action based on it.
I'm sorry?
She never took legal action under state law. And she'd filed a timely charge under state mm-hmm. law. And my question was, did she then make a legal claim in court under state law?
She did not file a claim in state court under state law. That's correct, Your Honor.
Or, for that matter, a pendant claim in federal court.
That's correct as well.
Okay.
But she did pursue it in the commission. And as I was stating near the end there, what the EEOC, while agreeing upon their substantial rate review with the Wisconsin Personnel Commission, did find that her claims were timely filed. So again, we have the misleading form. We have the letter from the chief legal counsel. And we have the EEOC itself saying that it was...
One more question. Are there any substantive differences between the federal law theory and the state law theory?
I'm not quite certain, to be honest with that, Judge Easterbrook.
Because if the state law provides the same substantive terms and relief as federal law, and this is something of a self-inflicted wound, right? You've made a timely claim under state law and not under federal law. And then you come to court and abandon the state law claim, pursue only the federal claim.
I would suspect, and again, I apologize, but I would suspect that there is a difference because otherwise you have one law that would be subsumed by the other. And if that's the case...
Perfectly common for state and federal anti-discrimination laws to be substantively identical.
Being the case, she didn't, as you questioned earlier, she didn't pursue that in state law, in state court, so therefore, it's not really a self-inflicted wound in the sense that there wouldn't be any res judicata, if that's what Your Honor is leading to.
No, not. Suppose you're a victim of discrimination or retaliation, you name it. You have a legal right, one under state law and one under federal law. Right? You've done what's necessary to preserve your state law claim and not what's necessary to preserve your federal law claim. And then, when the time comes to sue, you don't sue on the one you've preserved and do sue on the one you haven't preserved. Right? That's your classic self-inflicted wound. It's not clear why the court should then turn itself into a pretzel to preserve or kind of revivify the federal law claim.
I would agree, but I would also argue that due to the doctrine of equitable tolling, that federal claim has been preserved or should have been preserved, and it was error for the trial court to do so. What we have here, in addition to these misleading forms, is we also have something that would be incredibly confusing for a school counsel to find, the distinction between the 300-day and the 180-day difference. That is to say, not only do you have to go to Title VII, you then have to go to the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, which most pro se plaintiffs, I would submit, wouldn't even know what the CFR stands for.
Most pro se plaintiffs and all too many lawyers.
Precisely my point. But that's not enough. Then you've got to go to footnote 12, I believe, to get the distinction between whether it's a Fair Employment or an FEP agency or not. And in this case, the Wisconsin personnel is not for retaliation purposes either. So I think when we look at the combination of facts, as well as the fact that this was a motion for summary judgment, and I see my time is just about up, but my last statement was that all reasonable inferences are to be drawn in the non-movement's favor, and I would submit that the trial court did not do this in this case.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Gracie.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramsey.
Good May it please the Court. Your Honor, Judge Crabb was absolutely right when she said it's speculative to assume that Ms. Newbold might have been misled had she called the EEOC or had she read the code, the U.S. code, and seen, which, by the way, says 180 days, and then gone further and looked for a footnote, because the record evidence shows she made no such effort.
What's in this for the state, for the public defender? Are there any substantive differences between the state and federal theories of relief?
No, not to my knowledge, no. In fact, we cite federal law.
Then I'm totally flummoxed about what's going on here. You don't have to plead law in your complaint. Right? This pro se shows up in federal court and says, I'm trying to recover on a claim of employment discrimination or retaliation. And the complaint cites federal law, but since you don't have to plead law, why doesn't the district judge say, look, you filed a timely state claim. You can either invoke this pendant to the federal claim, or I will release pendant jurisdiction and go to state court.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand where you're coming from, Your Honor. She had the right to judicial review of the Personnel Commission's decision, which is within 8 days of hearing. She had a number of her claims tried. Substantively, the law is the same for all practical purposes. I think the Personnel Commission is a little more liberal, frankly, than this court is in terms of its interpretation of its anti-discrimination laws. The remedies are different. I don't think she's entitled to the same compensatory damages that she would be if she prevailed in a Title VII claim. That's where the real difference is. Getting back to the does that answer your question, Your Honor? Probably not.
Not completely.
Okay, well, if there's anything more, I'd be happy to answer it. Getting to the misleading aspect of this, first is a letter. She writes a letter to the Department of Employment Relations. This is the first time she's inquired as to discrimination. She made some earlier inquiries, requested her personnel file about whether she was entitled to a probation review and stuff like that. But 4 days after, the Department of Employment Relations gets that letter, and they're not the agency responsible for handling this.
Let me ask my question one final way.
Okay.
If the federal complaint had in it another thing, you know, count two, making the same claim under state law, would that have been timely?
Yeah, it would have been a request for judicial review, and it would have been timely. It would have been timely under state law. Okay. Yeah, certainly had that option. Chose instead to file this complaint in federal court. Getting back to the Department of Employment Relations, it wasn't the agency. 4 days later, the agency counsel writes and says, "Look, the Personnel Commission handles state law claims, and you got 300 days to file under state law." It actually cites the state law, Section 111, and the like, and she said, you better go talk to the Personnel Commission. 5 days later, she picks up the complaint form, and that complaint form clearly says state laws differ. And there's nothing misleading about that. Go contact the EEOC. The Personnel Commission is saying, you know, that we handle the state. If you're interested in your federal claims, go call the EEOC. They never did so. Now, we cited a poster in the EEOC compliance manual, and then some prior cases, Wheeldon v. Monin Corp., and I think it's Posey v. Parker, hosiery, in which this court held that when the EEOC gives out such post that type of notice, call us if you think you've been discriminated against. That's sufficient to put a claimant on notice that they ought to call the EEOC and find out what their rights are. What the plaintiff is asking this court to do here is impose upon the Personnel Commission a higher duty than that imposed upon the EEOC. And I don't see how you can ask the Personnel Commission to, frankly, do the EEOC's job for it. This Anderson v. Unisys case, it's the exact opposite of what happened here. In that case, the relevant language from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights said, it says you have 1 year, and if the charge alleges a violation of federal laws, the department will also file with the EEOC. They took it upon, and they had a work-sharing agreement. They were agents, essentially, of the EEOC. They essentially, with that language, said, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. You know, if there's a federal claim here, we'll file it. And that was misleading. Here, the Personnel Commission
wasn't misleading, but they didn't carry through either.
Yeah, well, they didn't carry through either. But,
They never carried through, but it was a little late.
It was a little late. They never. They said, "Look, we'll take care of it."
They were operating on a Postal Service time schedule.
Yeah, they gave them half the information. You know, they said, "Well, we'll take care of it," but they didn't tell them, "Oh, you better get in with 300 days for a federal claim." Whereas in this case, again, the Personnel Commission said, "Look, laws differ. call the EEOC if you got any problems, and or, you know, if you have any more questions, and she just never did. To get to the second point, there's also an argument, Judge Crabb, and I don't think we need to get that far, frankly, but Judge Crabb did say, you know, it would have been untimely because it was filed with the EEOC over 300 days anyway, and that this relates to the Personnel Commission's delay in forwarding the her complaint to the EEOC, even though the checkbox said we will forward it to the EEOC. Again, first off, she received the complaint form on December 27, 1995, waited 4 months, signed it, then waited another month, and then filed it. And this is a lot like Cotta v. Baxter Healthcare, where the individual, again, just waited 8 months and got real close to the deadline and actually missed the deadline. You know, there's no reasonable justification for waiting that long after you get the form, and you should, you know, you just file it. It takes a couple days, and you know, on those facts, I don't think there's any basis for invoking equitable tolling. And again, she did have all the facts she needed to, you know, if she had any question about whether, you know, what EEOC's procedures are, what they meant by forwarding a complaint, you know, and the like, she could have called the EEOC and found out, but again, she never did. And lastly, the plaintiff raises this issue about this second retaliation claim. And, you know, I think Your Honor's going to read Judge Crabb's opinion. She does a very thorough analysis of her one claim. She'll have one claim to go forward, and there's no similar analysis of this, quote, second retaliation claim, and she clearly considered it just as further evidence to get Newbold into court, because the 6 week time gap between the protected activity and the adverse action is too much, at least in this circuit. And so you can read the complaint. And I believe that's it. You know, well, no, it's not. I mean, she did waive it, because I mean, you read the that's it. Your Honors, don't have any more questions. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Gracie? They will perforce be quick, boy.
Of course. First, with regard to what Mr. Ramsey was saying about Anderson, it did say if you'd like us to file it with the EEOC, we will do so. That's precisely what the form says here. If you would like us to forward the complaint to the EEOC, we will do so. If they didn't want to do so, they shouldn't put that in the form.
Well, they did forward it.
They did forward it, but for some reason.
They waited 4 months.
They waited 4 months, and we have no explanation. There's nothing in the record as to why. And we will never
but
know.
They did what the form said.
But they did what the form said, as did what the form in the Anderson, in the Eighth Circuit Anderson case did. They forwarded as well, but again, they waited too long, and there the court said that, you know what, we're not gonna tolerate that, and we're gonna toll the statute in that case. The second thing with regard to the speculative nature of what Newbold could have done, I mean, this court again in a case cited by Mr. Ramsey, the Cata case, said for equitable tolling, all he needs show, he being a plaintiff, is that he could not, by the exercise of reasonable diligence, have discovered essential information bearing on his claim. Again, what Newbold had to work with here was she had to work with very complicated
reasonable factual information. I don't understand why you're arguing equitable tolling rather than equitable estoppel.
Well, because
I've never before heard an argument that equitable tolling is available when a person would have had difficulty researching the law.
Well, because I think the difference between equitable tolling and equitable estoppel, I see my time is up.
Equitable estoppel is the doctrine that applies on account of misconduct by the person sued, and that's the claim being made here.
If I may finish, yes. No, I don't believe that there's been anything willful or wanton done by the state. I think it's merely...
It doesn't have to be willful or wanton. It can be negligent. If you promise, for example, not to plead the statute of limitations, and then for negligently you fail to keep that, but you fully intended to keep the promise, it's still a basis of equitable estoppel.
I think that's right, and I think there's a lot in the case law regarding that confusion by the various courts. But I, after reviewing the case law and the facts of this case, I do believe it is an equitable tolling case, not equitable estoppel. But under either theory, the district court respectfully was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gracie, and thanks very much to you and your law firm for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much.